A warm welcome to new listeners and old friends. This is the latest episode of Talking Golf.
That player has never had that level of service off someone. Now, I like to work away off-site and strip their clubs back, get feedback off them, look at their stats, look at their strengths of what they're using, look at their opportunities, and really analyse where you can help them.
Welcome to Talking Golf. This week we're at the Irish Open after a couple of weeks' break because we've been running all over the running all over Europe at big events. I'm very lucky to be joined by Liam McDougall, who works for Titleist, and today we're going to talk a little bit about the new Titleist driver launch, which was last week in France, talk a little bit about Liam's role on tour, how he works with his players, what he sees as the key skills for being an equipment technician out here. So why don't we just start by you telling us a little bit about what you do, what your role is, and then we'll let it roll from there.
So my role with Titleist is that I'm European Tour Manager of Golf Club Fitting and Development. So that entails the management of the fitting process on tours. So I work mainly European Tour and just recently now doing an amount of events per quarter in America and visiting R&D on a regular basis as well. Having a close relationship with those guys so we understand the product to its full capacity and helping them develop future products to bring the high-performing clubs that we can out here, really.
So the TS2, TS3 were introduced last week in France. That's about 5-6 weeks after the launch in the States.
We had the launch at the US Open, which was shortly. We then done the Travelers on the PGA Tour, and then a week after that was obviously the French Open for the European guys. We had a vast success at the US Open with a number of guys, 17 guys, putting it straight in play at the US Open.
Well, unheard of at a major.
And especially, you know, it being a major and at Shinnecock Hills, it was a pretty big accolade for the guys to do that. Furthermore, at France, we, out of 25 staff players, had 23 play it first week out. So we're just revisiting a couple of guys that didn't this week and just checking in with everyone, make sure there's no concerns, getting feedback on the product from its first week out, and it's been a resounding success. We're just trying to manage the non-contract guys now asking to test the product because when something's good, as you know out here, everyone tends to then want to have
a look
at what's going on in case they're missing something. And we're happy that we've got a product that's fast and high performing, so we're happy to just manage people's expectations.
And that seems to be the big difference with this new product, is that while Titleist have always produced very handsome looking golf clubs, it could potentially be criticised for not being quite as fast as some of the other brands out there. This seems to be equally, or in some instances, faster than the other brands.
There was a perception out there that we in-house were looking at, and we came up with the concept of this driver being TS, which has an effect name of Titleist Speed Project, which the R&D team, Stephanie and her team, were done a massive amount of work and stripping back the product with a focus of improving the speed aspect of the two products to make it as fast as anything out here, if not being the fastest
and
product.
Traditionally, Titleist would have one sort of more traditional driver that was slightly slower but very classic looking, and then one more high performance that was a little bit quicker but maybe not quite as easy in the eye.
Yeah. And we've got two products still, TS2, TS3. The TS2 is a very high MOI, very forgiving product.
What would these guys, for instance, how would they benefit from a higher MOI? And how would the sort of club golfer or listener benefit from higher MOI?
You're getting a bigger area that's going to maintain ball speed across a larger area when you pull the MOI back. So it's making the club more stable. Golf's hard enough, so if you can make something a bit quicker and make it more stable, you're hitting best of both worlds. Weirdly enough, the only problem, not problem, it's a good problem, the only guys that haven't put TS2 into play and have opted for TS3, is strangely enough, TS2 was too stable.
Yeah.
So if somebody was seeing it moving 10 yards right to left or left to right, they were opting to keep that shape in TS3, where TS2 is just extremely straight driver.
And that's certainly something we've seen. The player that I work with, that we tested with last week, was he couldn't create the amount of shape that he wanted with the TS2. And while it sounds like a nice problem to have, for a lot of these guys, their safety mechanism is being able to see a certain amount of shape and being able, and knowing that the ball is going to do a certain thing.
It's great just now because you've got, for me working in it, you've got, if a player is, yourself as a coach out here, if you're just trying to get someone to hit more fairways, you can deliver that aspect with a bit of speed. You're brilliant in his world. If you're trying to keep someone to what they're used to seeing and give them a bit more speed and make things more pleasing to the eye, we've got a product there that's going to do that in TS3. So it's pretty exciting times for us as a golf business. Yeah. It's pretty exciting times, and we've certainly, there's a lot of passionate people at head office from our club business, with Steve Pelisic heading that up, down to us guys here, that we're excited and we think we've got something special.
I mean, one of the things that, I mean, I'm a Titleist brand ambassador, so I'm on your side if you like, but what the sort of common conception about Titleist is that it's a very traditional, very safe brand, and the products reflect that. And one of my frustrations speaking with you over the course of the last 18 months has been, well, actually, the product is very technologically advanced, extremely high performing, and that message potentially needs to get communicated to the consumer more.
Yeah, and I think one of the things you said at the start of the interview was that there was a perception there that we were maybe a wee bit slower, but we were very forgiving. And that really annoyed us, because I had players out here, I tested with several non-contacted players, one of your guys as well, and he tested every brand and opted to put our brand in play. So there are success stories there. Maybe we just didn't educate the consumers as well as what we could have. But you learn from your mistakes, and hopefully now we've got high-performing driver and we can educate better.
It's a recipe that's worked pretty well for Titleist over the years.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's change direction a little bit and find out more about your background, how you ended up doing this for a living. What was you're a good player. Funnily enough, we met each other. I coached you.
Yeah.
And you were working for TaylorMade at the time.
That's right, yeah.
Moved to Titleist 18 months ago?
2.5 years ago.
Oh, Christ, okay. Yep, got that wrong.
That's critical at Titleist, by the way, because they really praise themselves on the length of service you provide to
loyalty,
the company.
Loyalty is crucial.
2.5 years is like 2 weeks.
So how did you end up doing this on tour? What was the sort of journey you took?
As you said, they're starting off in a golf shop in Glasgow in World of the Golf, which was a pretty high retail shop, you know, at a turnover of X number of million a year. So I started off there and learnt custom fitting there. Took a gamble taking a 6-month job at TaylorMade.
And did that require you to move south?
Not initially. Okay. I took a gamble doing the fitting events and just started working and learning and studying from that perspective, and moved eventually down south to head up TaylorMade's performance labs across Europe and centres.
Yeah.
And luckily enough, I met a guy, Benoit Vincent, that was the head engineer at TaylorMade at the time, and I asked him privately. I was actually asked to drive him around in the car. And I asked him if he would share his knowledge and let me ask him questions and learn his engineering knowledge. He gave me some of that knowledge that he had, and I combined the fitting aspect with the engineering knowledge, and it was a good combination of knowing your fitting stuff and knowing the engineering aspect of the products. That really interested me, and that combination worked really well. And then the opportunity came at Titleist. It was a brand that I played as a kid, growing up and playing as, you know, I think it's 962s when Duval played them years ago, and playing the driver that Duval played and Tiger at the time. So Titleist was always that player's brand.
Yeah.
And when I eventually came over to Titleist, it was like, I said this to someone and they started laughing. It was like supporting your football team and eventually going to play for them and being in it. It's hard to, when you're in it, it's just got great values. It's got, you know, loyal employees, and they just do things the right way, I think.
And the message that's still, we touched on it already, that it's got this incredible whether it's brand values or the ethics that the company's built on. But the thing that doesn't get communicated often enough is how phenomenal the product is.
Yeah, yeah. But very, you're probably right, and that's it's understated,
yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
So you're, we don't shout about it and we don't market, not market enough, but we could maybe do better at telling people we've got good product.
Yeah. And ultimately it's something that, as the market gets more and more and more competitive,
yeah,
and there is good product out there from, or great product out there from pretty much every manufacturer,
yeah,
that at some point you're going to have to sort of stick your hand up and say, no, actually, have a look at ours. It really does perform very well.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're here Tuesday evening. We've both been here since early this morning. Talk the listeners through a sort of typical week for you on the road in your role.
Preparation starts as soon as the end of play, Sunday from the previous week.
Yep.
So I look at stats, compile a list of stats, check in with players that you've maybe worked with the week before.
Mm.
You look at how guys are performing. And I was joking with someone yesterday that I spend my life looking at a European Tour app. That I look at the first 10 players and see, right, is any of my guys doing well? And then I scroll right to the very bottom and I check who's having a nightmare, because that's where the work starts. Yeah, so we do a lot of look at the performance of the guys and then looking at what we've got orders-wise to build, any preparation we need to do. We have a team meeting on a Monday morning with any outlines of work we've got to undertake as a team.
And you do that on site?
We do that on site on the Monday morning prior to opening. There's a good structure of following a methodological path.
Yeah.
And going through the right way of practice. I mean, we take it personally, as you will when you're working with a player. If something goes well, it's almost like, okay,
you are invested in it.
Job's done.
Yeah.
Like you're content.
Yeah.
You're never overwhelmed in this job. You're always content, like you've done your job, whereas you're always looking at who's struggling to try and help them. And sometimes, no doubt, it will yourself, you'll rack your brain.
Oh, I mean, it's just the parallels between what you do and what I do are numerous, that ultimately you are invested in every one of your athletes' games. I mean, I've always found it a challenge personally to not get particularly down if things aren't going well, but likewise, when things are going well, you need to keep a lid on it and just accept that it does go in waves, it does go in cycles, and all you can do is support the athlete as best you can for where they are in those cycles.
Yeah. One of the things on Saturday evening, Scott Jameson, one of our players, he was the only player in France that I couldn't get more distance out with a new driver.
Yeah.
And Scott's a friend of mine, first and foremost, but it baffled me because I had him built up about this product and it was the same as his old one, and I knew I could get him something.
Yeah.
Saturday evening I was sitting, I had a bottle of wine and I was pretty bored. It was annoying me that much. I've got my iPad out, I'm looking at the numbers. I text Scott a WhatsApp message at 11:30 PM on Saturday night and he came back, I love the dedication. But I just text him, I found a way. I know why we didn't. And we got something
got
sorted
this morning,
yeah.
These guys who play for a living, the best in the game, they still want exactly the same as the club golfer. Something that hits it further and straighter.
Marginal gains.
And I helped Scott with his short game, so I've been involved in this process a little bit. And speaking to Scott last week, he was tangibly disappointed that the product wasn't.
Yeah, so thankfully we got him sorted this morning.
I mean, I don't want to be critical of club fitters anywhere, but it strikes me they fall into either very good or very run-of-the-mill. And that, I'm afraid, counts out here as well.
Yeah.
There are some fairly run-of-the-mill guys working out here and some exceptionally good guys working out here, of which I'd count you one of the exceptionally good guys. What are the differences between a great custom fit and someone reading numbers off an iPad?
Detail.
Okay, so elaborate a little bit more.
I said to one of our VPs that I made a career on detail, so I make sure that when I do a fitting, that if someone goes in after me and have went in before me, that player has never had that level of service off someone. Now, I like to work away off-site and strip their clubs back, get feedback off them, look at their stats, look at their strengths of what they're using, look at their opportunities, and really analyse where you can help them.
All of which, on the face of it, have very little to do with actually building them a suitable golf club.
Correct. You need to show them that you care.
Yeah.
So I'd say detail and care. It's, you do sometimes get guys that are quick fixed out here, but that'll only be a plaster on something for a while. If you've got your process and you've put a lot of time and dedication into it, players really appreciate it, and players talk. You know, there's a lot of players that will come to you after you've given someone a good experience that they'll say, he knows his stuff and that product performs, he's worth spending some time with. And that's the best compliment you can get, when a player says to you, oh, so-and-so said you've done some good work with him, I'd love to...
And that's ultimately how you ended up doing some stuff in PGA Tour, wasn't it? That a couple of the players who had played in Europe and got PGA Tour cards had said, actually, no, I'd like Liam to look after my equipment.
Yeah, there's a couple of guys you do some work with, and they go back and say, we've had a great experience with Liam. And, but, you know, we've got good guys, and I think something that our Mac Fitz, our boss at the moment, and Chris Tootin, one of my colleagues, JJ, over in America, JJ and I are on the same page most of the time, 99% of the time. And Mac and Chris identified that we were maybe a bit in front of where other people were. And they put in together a fitting summit. And JJ and I conducted a fitting summit on what we found out to be best practices and how we go about our job. And it isn't about us being better, it's about us pulling up the guys to make the brand better, because the one thing you never forget at this brand is that it's about Titleist, it's not about you. And I struggle with praise.
I think that's a West of Scotland thing, or maybe just
if somebody gives you praise, I quickly try and change the subject or get out of it, or defer it to someone else, which is
but actually I think that equips you quite well to function out here, in that you don't get too giddy when things are going extremely well. You don't become too carried away with how fantastic you are at what you do, because around the corner something's going to go belly up at some point.
Some of the best work that I've been involved in is working with a player who's really down a bad path, and you're trying to pull them out of that and put them on a new path. That's where I get the best out of that, where you can help someone make a living.
Yeah, correct.
And pull them away from being in a dark room, basically, in a dark corner.
Because there's so few, outside of professional sport, there's so few businesses where your success and failure is so public.
Yeah.
And when I first came out here, it always amazed me at how upset people got and how down people get. I completely understand it now. This is young men in this environment who they have spent their entire life dreaming of playing Irish Opens around great golf courses against Rory McIlroy, against John Rahm. And I now can totally relate to why they're so invested in it. And being able to help them, as you say, climb out of a dark hole and get even just tiny wee gains is huge. And some of the most rewarding coaching experiences are when you take a guy who's really underperforming and maybe just get him to keep his card or help him keep his card.
Yeah, it means as much to them as it does to the guys winning. I find golf out here, like, I used to play professional football, and you can be ordinary at football and you can make a living. You know, you've got a contract for 4 years, right? I'm on £150,000 a week for 4 years. It didn't matter how you play, because you've got your secure blanket for 4 years. Out here,
you can be great.
You need to perform out here. So it's such a hard sport. And then to like define success out here, I think a lot of players out here don't define their own success. So
absolutely,
there's only one person this week that can win.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of guys that can have success. Like I just said to Chris Wood this morning in the range, it's like, take loads of positives out of that last week. That's a great performance. Well done. You can be confident about that.
Because he tweeted on Sunday night that he was disappointed. He still wasn't happy with where his game was at.
Yeah, and his swing wasn't there. And you're going, well, if that's where you can get to when you're not quite on, you must be absolutely thrilled, because you're basically cleaning up if you're on.
Correct. And he's good enough to be able to get into that category. And that to me is what's the difference between the good and the great out here? The good pick up big checks, win tournaments when they're playing well. The great can do it pretty much most of the time.
Yeah.
So we're now into a 3-week spell of Lynx Golf. How's the makeup of players' bags changing? I mean, I've worked with all six of my guys today. and every one of them has been experimenting with equipment because of the different demands of Lynx Golf.
Yeah.
Obviously, you need to stock the truck slightly differently. How many of your players are you experiencing the same thing?
Absolutely. You see a lot of two irons going in play. The guys will hit a lot of them off a tee. You'll do a lot of heel relief. You're changing bounce from being high bounce to low bounce. You're almost checking in on guys to make sure they're happy with the wedge setup they've got in the minute. Wedges will probably be the big thing. And then all through the bag, really, but wedges would be the bigger thing, like for the versatility around the greens here, from being Lynx Golf to going to back to Parkland, especially.
And it's interesting how I think, by and large, the big tournaments around the tougher courses tend to lend themselves more towards strong irons off tees rather than 3-wood, 5-wood. Because last week in France, again, very strong test, maybe not the longest course on tour, but premium is on accuracy and getting the ball moving forwards, not getting it up in the air at all.
I loved watching it last week because it just makes a refreshing difference from watching a golf course where you can just hit it as hard as you want, you can hit it as far as you want, and it, you can be offline, you can find it, you can hit it on. I mean, there were six drivers last week, someone, you know, one of the guys saying, I think Justin Thomas spoke to Peter Ewling and just said, man, it's tight out here. I loved hearing that he thought it was tight and different and just a different
challenge for him. It's nice to have tournaments. I mean, I've been quite critical privately and publicly about the way the courses have been set up this year. I think a lot of instances they're set up to suit bombers who maybe lack control. My biggest criticism is that a lot of the courses have been set up to have almost taken course management out of the equation.
Mm.
But going from Cologne a couple of weeks ago to France to these next 3 weeks, it's really refreshing to see not just a player's ability to produce the shots, but also to select the correct ones.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And that's true championship golf.
Yeah, 100%.
To see great courses like Dubai reduced to a 5-under cut because of the way the course has been set up just baffles me.
Yeah, I'm with you. I enjoy watching it instead of watching a shootout, really.
Yeah.
It's more challenging for the guys, and the Ryder Cup will be interesting in France, you know, in September, just seeing if it will be the same setup, the golf course, and see how the guys cope with it.
I walked onto that first tee on Tuesday morning last week and thought, Christ, I cannot think of a more terrifying opening tee shot in the Ryder Cup.
And all the holes, you know, cater for that theatre.
Yeah, just pure drama.
So it should be good. You know, it's got the success. The recipe for success.
European team's shaping up incredibly well.
It's going to be, I think it'll be pretty tight.
Yeah, so do I.
I think it'll be pretty, you've got exceptional talents on both sides, and I think it'll be pretty tight.
A lot of it will boil down to how your rookies perform, I think.
Yeah.
Particularly this time. So we've heard a lot about the ball going too far and courses having to adjust, which I don't subscribe to that. Where do you think equipment technology is going to go over the course of the next 5 or 10 years?
What a question. I think when we say it about the players out here, it's marginal gains.
Yeah.
There's parameters that are set by the governing bodies. And if one thing we pride ourselves on as a company is quality and high performance. So, and quality assurance that you're getting the right thing that you order.
Yeah.
You know, our precision, our process, our owning the process, we call it, from start to finish. That's what we pride ourselves on as a brand. And I think we're ahead of the game with that, for me. Going forward, technology, our R&D guys are working night and day trying to raffle their brains to see where the next steps are. You never know in golf. You never know what, you know, it's someone just comes out with something. You look how far golf has came from when it was woods, now to metal woods, movable weight technology.
And that's been a big game changer, I think. I think that's, I mean, it's something that's made your job almost harder in that you need to have, for me, when, I mean, going back to a question I asked earlier about what's the difference between a good and a great fit.
Mm.
To me, it's understanding how to get the very best out of your technology. You don't need to be an expert at everyone else's technology, but you need to know that if I can make this perform for how the player delivers it, what their miss tendency is, what their shot shapes are, what the preferred trajectories are. And I think that with the movable weight technology, that's become harder for you guys to master that.
Mm-hmm.
gone are the days we used to get up with someone wood that you quite like the look of, and then you'd spend 6 months trying to figure out a way to hit
it.
Yeah,
and then trying to bend it yourself. And
yeah.
Our job, my job's a lot easier from the equipment. I love working with our SureFit sleeve.
Yeah.
When you're moving lie angle, you can move strike location.
Yeah.
That to me just is brilliant to work with. It's brilliant to work with. And then I think for us, when you've got movable weight, if someone's really struggling on a Wednesday and they're going, right, I just want to not hit it left.
The quick fix for that week.
You can put a plaster on it on the Wednesday and catch up with them and their coach on the Monday of the following event and work together. And that's a thing probably that I never touched on that I like to do is make sure that I'm on the same path as the coach.
Because I mean, we've discussed this quite a lot over the years, that it baffles me that a player would be happy working, particularly when they're trying to go into a new product or change something, that they'd be happy doing it without knowing that the manufacturer and the coach are on exactly the same path.
Yeah, exactly. I think we worked together with Lucas Beggard and the success he had on the back of what you'd done as a coach and get him in a product that he was confident in, that he could then listen to you to produce what you'd done and go on and win in Portugal, right?
Yeah, Portugal last year.
Was good. And to see him, for me, Lucas is one of the nicest guys out here. So to see Lucas from where he was to where he is now, to hear him last week on the range moaning at you when he finished the fifth, I was like, this is a different animal now.
Yeah.
Well, which is good.
I'm quite happy for any of them to moan if they're going to finish top five
every week.
So final question, how would youngsters out there who want to get into the golf industry, obviously from the outside looking in, life on tour seems to be glamorous and sexy and we get to see all these wonderful places, which is absolutely true, but equally it has its downsides. How would you encourage them to get into your side of the business? It's obviously a recognised path if you want to get into coaching, but what about club fitting, club technology?
You've got to start somewhere, and I'm always an open door to guys, so we've got some of our product specialists out here this week. Every week we welcome people from each respective areas, whatever countries they're in. We're an open door, and if we can give them knowledge and bring them up, and when across your travels you might find someone and you'll go, he's pretty good, or he has potential. And I love when guys send me emails and they say, I want to come out on tour for the week and see what you guys are doing, and they ask questions.
So what would you look for? What would those qualities be?
I look for someone that probably, I can't really say it on air, but someone that would bugger it up.
Yep. Absolutely.
But work it out.
Yeah.
Someone once told me, if you're messing it up, you're working it out. Be confident enough to get out there and work with a player and just work out. You know, you're going to make mistakes.
But modern society doesn't view failure as something that is part of developing.
Yeah.
And that applies to corporate structure, where ultimately if someone fails, they're like, well, he's failed. That means he's not good.
You take it back to myself last week, I would have said I failed with Scott Jameson. So, you know, I'm figuring it out. I've got everyone else, but the one thing that stuck in my head from that week, we've had the most guys ever put the driver in play in the first week. The one thing that I'm coming away with is I couldn't get Jamo into a new driver because it wasn't better performing, and that annoyed me. So I've buggered it up. And I've went away and I've studied it and I've went, right, maybe I can go down this way. And it's just figuring it out and having the confidence.
You need a culture that accepts that.
Absolutely.
It's all right, Liam, you screwed up or you didn't quite get it right. But we understand that's part of the process.
We've got a young lad out this week, Will Harvey, who's just started doing the wedge stuff with Bob Volkey and Aaron Dill.
Yeah.
We had a team meeting on Monday morning and he said, I'm just going to walk about and, you know. And I've said, pretty abruptly, you ain't doing that. You're going to get in, you're going to get your hands dirty, you're going to touch bases with players, experience with players. Yep. I'll introduce you to the guys. Go out and get it done and have a good week. You don't want to walk about and come away going, yeah, it was okay, I walked a few holes. Make a difference.
Yeah.
Go out there.
And understand what it's like. And
absolutely. Yeah. You're going to make mistakes.
Yeah.
Learn. I never think that I know everything. And I listen to yourself coaching, listen to other guys coaching, and you'll pick up bits from what you guys are saying. I'll speak to R&D, I'll speak to my colleagues. We all share, and me, myself and one of my colleagues, JJ, at the minute, we're like encouraging sharing platforms at work with the other fitters. One of the things I said at the R&D meeting was, a lot of jargon gets spoken from really and highly intelligent people, you've got a room full of people going, yep, nodding. Nobody knows half of the words that are being spoken. And you're going, we need to strip it back and learn them a bit better and be armoured better and smarter.
Liam, thank you so much. It's been fascinating
talking
to you.
I really appreciate
your time. I know it's taken a couple of false starts.
No problem.
Mainly because I forgot to put batteries in my recorder. But I hope we can do this again at some point. And I hope that the listener finds this kind of conversation worthwhile, because this side of the business really fascinates me.
Yeah.
And understanding how much difference the right equipment can make for any player.
I need to ask you one thing before we finish. You need to get Laurie Cantor and Eddie Pepperell on together with a bottle of wine and just have a debate about golf, because that would go global.
Well, Laurie and Eddie, I hope you listen to this. I know Laurie's listened to a couple of episodes. I'll happily get you both on at some point.
Can't wait to hear that one.
I will wait for you to approach me and we'll get those two round the table with a nice bottle of red.
Thank you.
Liam, thanks very much. Take care.